I'd like to welcome you to the second of three events featuring and celebrating Nobel laureate José Saramago and his works. Today we have the pleasure of listening to Mr. Saramago read from his novels. He has chosen passages from O Evangelho Segundo Jesus Cristo, published in 1991 and translated as The Gospel According to Jesus Christ, Ensaio sobre a Cegueira, published in 1995 and translated as Blindness, Todos os Nomes, published in 1997 and translated as All the Names, and finally A Caverna, published in 2000. Maite Conde and Brent James, graduate students from our department, have graciously offered to read from the English translations, all of which are published by Harcourt, and many of which, all of these are available for purchase in the lobby. By way of a brief introduction for those of you who do not read in Portuguese, I offer Harcourt's description of the English translation of A Caverna to be published as The Cave in November 2002. Cipriano Algor, an elderly potter, lives with his daughter Marta and her husband Marcel in a small village in the outskirts of the center, an imposing complex of shops, apartment blocks, offices, and sensation zones. Marcel works there as a security guard, and Cipriano drives him to work each day before delivering his own humble pots and jugs. On one such visit, he is told not to make any more deliveries until further notice. People prefer plastic, he's told. It lasts longer and doesn't break. Unwilling to give up his craft, Cipriano tries his hand at making ceramic dolls. Astonishingly, the center places an order for hundreds of figurines, and Cipriano and Marta set to work. In the meantime, Cipriano meets a young widow at the graves of their recently departed spouses, and a hesitant romance begins. When Marta learns that she is pregnant and Marcel receives a promotion, they all move into an apartment in the center. Soon they hear a mysterious sound of digging, and one night Marcel and Cipriano investigate. Horrified by the discovery, the family, which now includes the widow and a dog, sets off in a truck heading for the great unknown. Suffused with the depth, humor, and above all, the extraordinary sense of humanity that marks each of his novels, The Cave is sure to become an essential book of our time. So without further delay, because I know you're anxious to hear him, let me say that it is an honor and a thrill for me to introduce to you José Saramago.
Vamos mudar a ordem da leitura, porque estivemos, a minha mulher Pilar e eu, não somos três, somos dois. E achámos que convinha mais, sobretudo para criar um efeito final, digamos, poético, para dizer assim, vamos fazer o contrário. Começamos pela caverna, passamos depois a todos os nomes. Em terceiro lugar, O Evangelho segundo Jesus Cristo. E em quarto lugar, Ensaio sobre a Cegueira. Então, tal como está, espero que estejam dizendo caridosamente os que sabem português ou outros que não saibam aquilo que eu estou a dizer. Eu lerei, enfim, um parágrafo. E a leitura depois em inglês será feita por eles até ao final daquilo que tivermos, daquilo em que acordamos. Então, como eu disse, começo pela caverna, que se bem entendi o que a professora Elizabeth disse, eu creio que ela resumiu já um pouco o conflito, a história. O livro será publicado aqui em outubro e nessa altura já vereis que pode parecer um livro um pouco apocalíptico, mas como eu creio que nós estamos vivendo num apocalipse cotidiano, o apocalipse de todos os dias, Não está mal que um autor que se preocupa com, enfim, com o mundo, com a espécie a que pertence, veja e pretenda comunicar aos seus leitores o que é que efetivamente há de apocalíptico no imediato e com mais preocupação, digamos assim, no futuro. Vamos ler então. Vamos ler. É o princípio do livro. O homem que conduz a caminhoneta chama-se Cipriano Algor. É oleiro de profissão e tem 64 anos, posto que à vista pareça menos idoso. O homem que está sentado ao lado dele é o genro, chama-se Marçal Gajo e ainda não chegou aos 30. De todo modo, com a cara que tem, ninguém lhe daria tantos. Como já se terá reparado, tanto um como o outro levam colados ao nome próprio uns apelidos insólitos, cuja origem, significado e motivo desconhecem. O mais provável será sentirem-se desgostosos. Há qualquer coisa neste som que não me está a agradar. O mais provável será sentirem-se desgostosos se alguma vez vierem a saber que aquele algor significa frio intenso do corpo, pronunciador de febre, e que o gacho é nada mais nada menos que a parte do pescoço do boi em que assenta a canga. O mais novo veste uniforme, mas não está armado. O mais velho traz um casaco civil e umas calças mais ou menos a condizer, leva a camisa sobriamente fechada no colarinho, sem gravata. As mãos que manejam o volante são grandes e fortes, de camponês, e não obstante, talvez por efeito do cotidiano contacto com as maciezas da argila a que o ofício obriga, prometem sensibilidade. Na mão direita de Marçal Gajo não há nada de particular, mas as costas da mão esquerda apresentam uma cicatriz com aspecto de queimadura, uma marca em diagonal que vai da base do polegar à base do dedo mínimo. A caminhoneta não merece esse nome, é apenas uma furgoneta de tamanho médio, do modelo fora de moda e vai carregada de louça. Quando os dois homens saíram de casa, 20 quilómetros atrás, o céu ainda mal começara a clarear. Agora amanhã já pôs no mundo luz bastante para que se possa observar a cicatriz de Marçal Gajo e adivinhar a sensibilidade das mãos de Cipriano Algor. Vem viajando a velocidade reduzida por causa da fragilidade da carga e também pela irregularidade do pavimento da estrada. Entrega de mercadorias não consideradas de primeira ou segunda necessidades, como é o caso das louças rústicas, faz-se de acordo com os horários fixados a meio da manhã. E se estes dois homens madrugaram tanto, foi porque Marçal Gajo tem de marcar o ponto pelo menos meia hora antes de as portas do centro serem abertas ao público. Nos dias em que não traz o genro, mas tem louças para transportar, Cipriano Algor não precisa de se levantar tão cedo. Contudo, de 10 em 10 dias, é sempre ele quem se encarrega de ir buscar Marçal Gajo ao trabalho para passar com a família as 40 horas de folga a que tem direito e quem, depois, com louça ou sem louça na caixa da furgoneta, pontualmente o reconduz às suas responsabilidades e obrigações de guarda interno. A filha de Cipriano Algor, que se chama Marta, de apelido Isasca, por parte da mãe já falecida, e Algor, por parte do pai, só goza da presença do marido em casa e na cama 6 noites e 3 dias em cada mês. Na noite antes desta, ficou grávida, mas ainda não o sabe.
The man driving the truck is called Cipriano Algor. He is a potter by profession and is 64 years old, although he certainly does not look his age. The man sitting beside him is his son-in-law, Marçal Gajo, and he is not yet 30. Nevertheless, from his face, too, you would think him much younger. As you will have noticed, attached to their first names, both these men have unusual family names, whose origin, meaning, and reason they do not know. They would probably be most put out to learn that Algor means the intense cold one feels in one's body before a fever sets in, and that Gajo is neither more nor less than the part of an ox's neck on which the yoke rests. The younger man is wearing a uniform, but is unarmed. The older man has on an ordinary jacket and a pair of more or less matching trousers, and his shirt is soberly buttoned up to the neck with no tie. The hands grasping the wheel are large and strong, peasant's hands, and yet, perhaps because of the daily contact with soft clay inevitable in his profession, they also suggest sensitivity. There is nothing unusual about Marcel Gachou's right hand, but there is a scar on the back of his left hand that looks like the mark left by a burn, a diagonal line that goes from the base of his thumb to the base of his little finger. The truck does not really deserve the name of a truck, since it is really only a medium-sized van, a kind now out of date. And it is laden with crockery. When the two men left home, 20 kilometers back, the day had barely begun to dawn. But now the morning has filled the world with sufficient light for one to notice Marcel Gachou's scar and to speculate about the sensitivity of Cipriano Algor's hands. The two men are traveling slowly because of the fragile nature of the load and also because of the uneven road surface. The delivery of merchandise not considered to be of primary or even secondary importance, as is the case with plain ordinary crockery, is carried out in accordance with official timetables at mid-morning. And the only reason these two men got up so early is that Marcel Gachou has to clock in at least half an hour before the doors of the center open to the public. On the days when he does not have to give his son-in-law a lift, but still has crockery to deliver, Cipriano Algor does not have to get up quite so early. However, every 10 days, he is the one who goes to fetch Marcel Gachou from work so that the latter can spend the 40 hours with his family to which he is entitled. And afterward, Cipriano Algor is also the one who, with or without crockery in the back of the van, punctually returns him to his responsibilities and duties as a security guard. Cipriano Algor's daughter, who is called Marta and bears the family name of Izaska from her late mother and Algor from her father, also enjoys the presence of her husband at home and in bed for 6 nights and 3 days every month. On the previous night, she became pregnant, although she does not yet know this. The area they are driving through is dull and dirty, not worth a second glance. Someone gave these vast and decidedly unrural expanses the technical name of the agricultural belt and also, by poetic analogy, the green belt. But the only landscape the eyes can see on either side of the road, covering many thousands of apparently uninterrupted hectares, are vast, rectangular, flat roof structures made of neutral colored plastic, which time and dust have gradually turned gray or brown. Beneath them, where the eyes of the passersby cannot reach, plants are growing. Now and then, trucks and tractors with trailers laden with vegetables emerge from side roads onto the main road, but most of these deliveries are done at night. And those appearing now either have express or an exceptional permission to deliver late, or else they must have overslept. Marcel Gachou discreetly pushed back the left sleeve of his jacket to look at his watch. He's worried because the traffic is gradually becoming denser, because he knows that, from now on, once they enter the industrial belt, things will only get worse. His father-in-law saw the gesture, but said nothing. This son-in-law of his is a nice fellow, but very nervous. They left the agricultural belt behind them, and the road, which grows dirtier now, crosses the industrial belt, cutting a swath through the not only factory buildings of every size, shape, and type, but also fuel tanks, both spherical and cylindrical, electricity substations, networks of pipes, air ducts, suspension bridges, tubes of every thickness, some red, some black, chimneys belching out pillars of toxic fumes into the atmosphere, long-armed cranes, chemical laboratories, oil refineries, fetid, bitter, sickly odors, the strident noise of drilling, the buzz of mechanical saws, the brutal thud of steam hammers, and very occasionally, a zone of silence where no one knows exactly what is being produced.
Esta leitura foi apenas uma pequena amostra de um livro que ainda não se conhece e, portanto, coloca uma situação, quer dizer, uma família de oleiros e um grande centro comercial, um grande mall enorme. E é, no fundo, é a relação de conflito e de considerando que o shopping center, o mall, num momento determinado diz que os produtos dessa olaria já não interessam ao público. E isso cria uma situação, digamos, em que uma família ou uma atividade profissional, oleiros deixam de saber como é que vão viver. No fundo, é uma situação muito corrente nos tempos de hoje. Passamos a todos os nomes é a história de um funcionário de um registro civil de uma cidade não identificada. É um funcionário como todos, um simples burocrata, que arruma, preenche fichas, organiza arquivos, e que um dia, por uma casualidade, desperta nele o interesse, a curiosidade de saber quem é uma determinada pessoa, e começa uma busca dessa pessoa. A história conta essa busca, como é que alguém que vive uma vida apagada, uma vida modesta, de repente sente que a necessidade de procurar outra pessoa, procurar o outro, introduz na sua própria vida um motivo diferente, um estímulo. A história é mais complexa do que isto, mas, enfim, é só para situar. E o que eu vou ler agora é quase uma parte, evidentemente, a parte quase no fim do livro, porque, enfim, este livro já está publicado em inglês, portanto, alguns dos que estão aqui já o conhecem. E o que acontece é que essa pessoa que ele procura, que é uma mulher, enfim, num momento sem que nós saibamos, nunca a encontramos, ele nunca a encontra, e ela suicida-se. Então ele vai ao cemitério saber, digamos, averiguar onde é que ela está, onde é que foi sepultada. No fundo, é uma história de amor entre uma pessoa que está viva e uma ausência de alguém que já não está vivo. A parte mais antiga do cemitério geral, a que se alargava por umas quantas dezenas de metros nas traseiras do edifício administrativo, era a que os arqueólogos preferiam para as suas investigações. As vetustas pedras, algumas tão gastas pelo tempo que só se conseguia distinguir nelas uns riscos meio desvanecidos que tanto poderiam ser restos de letras como resultado de desvios de um escopo inábil, continuavam a ser objeto de intensos debates e polémicas em que, perdida definitivamente na maior parte dos casos, a esperança de saber quem tinha sido posto debaixo delas apenas se discutia como uma questão vital a datação provável dos túmulos. Diferenças tão insignificantes como os míseros 100 anos para trás ou para diante eram motivo de longuíssimas controvérsias, quer públicas, quer académicas, do que resultavam quase sempre não só violentas rupturas de relações pessoais, como algumas mortais inimizades. As coisas, se é possível, iam, porém, a muito pior quando os historiadores e os críticos de arte apareciam a meter a colherada no assunto, pois se era relativamente fácil, ainda assim, fazer chegar a acordo a corporação dos arqueólogos sobre um conceito amplo de antigo, aceitável por todos, deixando as datas para depois, já a questão do belo e do verdadeiro punha os homens e as mulheres da estética e da história a puxar, da estética e da história, a puxar cada qual para o seu lado, não sendo nada raro ver um crítico mudar subitamente de opinião só porque a mudança de opinião de outro crítico fizera coincidir as duas. Ao longo dos séculos, a inefável paz do cemitério geral, com as suas alas de vegetação espontânea, as suas flores, as suas trepadeiras, as suas densas moitas, os seus festões e grinaldas, as suas urtigas e os seus cardos, as poderosas árvores cujas raízes muitas vezes desmontavam as pedras tumulares e faziam subir até à luz do solo uns surpreendidos ossos, havia sido alvo e testemunha de ferozes guerras de palavras e de uma ou outra passagem a vias de facto. Sempre que incidentes desta natureza sucediam, o curador começava por ordenar aos guias disponíveis que acudissem a separar os ilustrados discos, chegando até, quando alguma situação de imperiosa necessidade o exigiu, a apresentar-se em pessoa e figura para ironicamente recordar os pelejadores que não valia a pena estarem a despentear-se por tão pouco em vida, uma vez que tarde ou cedo ali viriam todos reunir-se, calvos. Do mesmo modo que o chefe da Conservatória do Registro Civil, o curador do Cemitério Geral cultiva com brilho o sarcasmo, o que confirma a presunção de que este traço de caráter seja tido por indispensável para aceder às suas altas e respectivas funções, a par, obviamente, dos competentes conhecimentos práticos e teóricos da técnica arquivística. Em alguma coisa, no entanto, historiadores, críticos de arte e arqueólogos reconhecem estar em consonância. O facto evidente do Cemitério Geral ser um catálogo perfeito, um mostruário, um resumo de todos os estilos, sobretudo arquitetura, escultura e decoração, e, portanto, um inventário de todos os modos de ver, estar e habitar existentes até hoje, desde o primeiro desenho elementar de um perfil do corpo humano, depois aberto e escavado a picão na pedra viva, até ao aço cromado, aos painéis refletores, às fibras sintéticas e às vidraças espelhadas, usados a torto e a direito na atualidade de que se tem vindo a falar. Seguirá agora a leitura com esta parte que eu li e o resto que foi combinado em inglês.
Okay, this is from all the names. The oldest part of the General Cemetery, which was a few dozen yards behind the administrative building, was the one preferred by archaeologists for their investigations. These ancient stones, some so worn by time that you could only make out a few barely visible marks that could as easily be the remains of letters as a result of scratches made by an unskilled chisel, continued to be the object of intense debate and polemic, in which, with no hope, in the majority of cases, of ever knowing who had been buried beneath them, archaeologists merely discussed, as if it were a matter of vital import, the probable date of the tombs. Such insignificant differences as a few hundred years here or there were the motor for long, long controversies, both public and academic, which almost always resulted in the violent breakup of personal relationships and even in mortal enmities. Things got still worse, if that were possible, when historians and art critics decided to stick their oar in, for while it was relatively easy in the circumstances for the Board of Archaeologists to reach agreement over a broad concept of antiquity acceptable to all, leaving aside actual date, the matter of truth and beauty created a veritable tug of war among the men and women of aesthetics and history, each pulling for their own side. And it was a not uncommon sight to see a critic suddenly changing his opinion simply because the changed opinion of another critic meant that they both now agreed. Throughout the centuries, the ineffable peace of the General Cemetery, with its banks of spontaneous vegetation, its flowers, its creepers, its dense bushes, its festoons and garlands, its nettles and its thistles, the powerful trees whose roots often dislodged tombstones and forced up into the sunlight a few startled bones, had been both the target of and a witness to fierce wars of words and to one or two physical acts of violence. Whenever incidents of this nature occurred, the keeper would begin by ordering the available guides to go and separate the illustrious contenders, and when some particularly difficult situation arose, he would go there in person to remind the fighters, ironically, that there was no point in tearing their hair out over such minor matters during their lifetime, since, sooner or later, they would all end up together in the cemetery, bald as coots. Just like the registrar, the keeper of the General Cemetery made brilliant use of sarcasm, which confirms the general assumption that this character trait had proved indispensable in their rise to their respective high ranks, together, of course, with a competent knowledge, both practical and theoretical, of archivistic technique. On one matter, however, historians, art critics, and archaeologists are in agreement. The obvious fact that the General Cemetery is a perfect catalog, a showcase, a summary of all styles, especially architectural, sculptural, and decorative, and therefore an inventory of every possible way of seeing, being, and living that has existed up until now. From the first elementary drawing of the outline of the human body, subsequently carved and chiseled out of a bare stone, to the chromium-plated steel reflecting panels, synthetic fibers, and mirrored glass, which are used willy-nilly in the current age. The first funerary monuments were made of dolmens, cromlechs, and menhirs. Then there appeared, like a great blank page in relief, niches, altars, tabernacles, granite bowls, marble urns, tombstones, smooth and carved, columns, Doric, Ionic, Corinthian, and composite, caryatids, friezes, and kynthuses, entablatures, and pediments, false vaults, real vaults, as well as stretches of brick wall. The gables of cyclopean walls, lancet windows, rose windows, gargoyles, oriel windows, timothems, pinnacles, paving stones, flying buttresses, pillars, pilasters, recumbent statues representing men in helmet, sword, and armor. Capitals with and without ornamentation, pomegranates, lilies, immortelles, campaniles, cupolas, recumbent statues representing women with small, hard breasts, paintings, arches, faithful dogs lying down, swaddled infants, the bearers of gifts, mourners with their heads covered, needles, moldings, stained glass windows, daisies, pulpits, balconies, more pinnacles, more timothems, more capitals, more arches, angels with wings spread, angels with wings folded, tondos, empty urns or urns filled with false stone flames or with a piece of languid crepe draped around them, griefs, tears, majestic men, magnificent women, delightful children cut down in the flower of life, old men and old women who could have expected no more, whole crosses and broken crosses, steps, nails, crowns of thorns, lances, enigmatic triangles, the occasional unusual marble dove, flocks of real doves wheeling above the cemetery, and silence. A silence interrupted only from time to time by the steps of the occasional sighing lover of solitude, drawn here by a sudden bout of sadness from the rustling outskirts where someone can still be heard weeping at a graveside on which they have placed bunches of fresh flowers, still damp with sap, piercing, one might say, the very heart of time, these 3,000 years of graves of every shape, meaning, and appearance, united by the same neglect, by the same solitude, for the sadness they once gave rise to is now too old for there to be any surviving heirs. Orienting himself with a map, although occasionally wishing he had a compass, Señor José walks towards the area set aside for suicides, where the woman on the cart is buried. But his step is slower now, less determined. From time to time, he stops to study a sculptural detail, stained by lichen or discolored by the rain. A few mourners caught in mid-lament, a few solemn depositions, a few hieratic folds, or else he struggles to decipher an inscription whose lettering attracted him in passing. It's understandable that even the very first line takes him a long time to decipher. For, despite having occasionally had to examine parchments more or less contemporary with these in the central registry, this clerk is not versed in ancient forms of writing, which is why he has never got beyond being a clerk. On top of a small rounded hillock, in the shadow of an obelisk that was once a geodesic marker, Señor José looks around him as far as he can see, and he finds nothing but graves rising and falling with the curves of the land, graves poised on the edge of the occasional precipitous slope and spreading out over the plains. "There are millions of them," he murmurs. Then he thinks of the vast amount of space they would have saved if the dead had been buried standing up, side by side, in serried ranks like soldiers at attention. And at their head, as the only sign of their presence there, a stone cube on which would be written, on the five visible sides, the principal facts about the life of the deceased. Five stone squares like five pages, the summary of a whole book that had proved impossible to write. Almost as far as the horizon, far, far into the distance, Señor José can see slowly moving lights, like yellow lightning, flicking on and off at constant intervals. They are the guides' cars calling to the people behind them, "Follow me, follow me." One of them suddenly stops. The light disappears. That means it's reached its destination. Señor José looked up at the sun, then at his watch. It's getting late. He'll have to walk fast if he wants to reach the unknown woman before dusk. He consulted the map, ran his index finger over it to reconstruct approximately the route he had followed from the administrative building to the place where he now finds himself, compared it with the distance he still has to walk, and almost lost courage. In a straight line, according to the scale, it would be about 3 miles, but, as we have already said, in this general cemetery, the straight, continuous line never lasts for long. To those three miles as the crow flies, you will have to add another 2, or possibly 3, traveling overland. Señor José calculated the amount of time left and the strength still remaining in his legs. He heard a prudent voice telling him to leave it for another day, when he had more time to visit the grave of the unknown woman, because now he knows where she is. Any taxi or bus could drop him off near to the actual place, skirting around the cemetery as families do when they come to weep over their loved ones and place new flowers in the jars or refresh the water, especially in summer. Señor José was still weighing this perplexing problem when he remembered his adventure at the school, the grim, rainy night, the steep, slippery mountain slope of the porch roof, and then, soaked from head to toe, his grazed knee rubbing painfully against his trousers, his anxious search inside the building, and how, by dint of tenacity and intelligence, he had managed to conquer his own fears and overcome the thousand difficulties that blocked his path until he discovered and finally entered the mysterious attic, confronting a darkness even more frightening than that in the archive of the dead. Anyone brave enough to do all that had no right to feel discouraged by the thought of a walk, however long it might be, especially when doing so in the frank brilliance of the bright sun, which, as we all know, is the friend of heroes. If the shades of dusk caught up with him before he had reached the unknown woman's grave, if night came to cut off all paths back, sewing them with invisible terrors and preventing him from going any farther, he could lie down on one of these mossy stones with a sad stone angel to watch over his sleep and wait for the birth of a new day. Or else he could shelter beneath a flying buttress like that one over there, thought Señor José. But then it occurred to him that farther on, he wouldn't find any flying buttresses. Thanks to the generations yet to come and to the consequent development of civil engineering, it won't be long before they invent less expensive means of holding up a wall. Indeed, it is in the general cemetery that the results of progress are set out before the eyes of the studious or the merely curious. There are even those who say that a cemetery like this is a kind of library which contains not books, but buried people. It really doesn't matter. You can learn as much from people as from books. Señor José looked back. From where he was, he could see only the roof ridge of the administrative building above the taller funerary monuments. I had no idea I'd come so far, he murmured. And having said that, as if in order to make a decision, he had needed only to hear the sound of his own voice, he once more continued on his way. When he had last reached the section of the suicides, with the sky already sifting the still white ashes of the dusk, he thought that he must have gone the wrong way or that there was something wrong with the map. Before him was a great expanse of field with numerous trees, almost a wood, where the graves apart from the barely visible gravestones seemed more like tufts of natural vegetation. You could not see the stream from there, but you could hear the lightest of murmurs slipping over the stones and in the atmosphere, which was like green glass. There hovered a coolness which was not just the usual coolness of the first hour of dusk. Being so recent, only a matter of a few days ago, the grave of the unknown woman must be on the outer limit of the area. The question was, in which direction? Señor José thought that the best thing, in order not to get lost, would be to walk over to the small stream and then go along the bank until he found the latest graves. The shadow of the trees covered him immediately, as if night had suddenly fallen. I should be afraid, murmured Señor José, in the midst of this silence among these tombs with these trees surrounding me. Instead, I feel as calm as if I were in my own house, except that my legs ache from having walked so much. Here's the stream. If I was afraid, I could leave here this minute. All I'd have to do was cross the stream. I'd just have to take my shoes and socks off and roll up my trouser legs, hang my shoes around my neck, and wade across. The water wouldn't even reach my knees. I'd soon be back in the land of the living again, with those lights over there that have just gone on. Half an hour later, Señor José reached the end of the field when the moon, almost full, almost completely round, was just coming up over the horizon. There the graves did not as yet have carved headstones to cover them, nor any sculptural adornments. They could only be identified by the white numbers painted on the black labels stuck in at the head of the grave, like hovering butterflies. The moonlight gradually spread over the field, slipped slowly through the trees like a habitual, benevolent ghost. In a clearing, Señor José found what he was looking for. He didn't take from his pocket the piece of paper the cemetery clerk had given him. He had made no particular effort to remember the number, but he knew it when he needed to, and now it was there before him, brilliantly lit, as if written in phosphorescent paint. Here she is, he said.
E a história, ou melhor, aquilo que leva Jesus ao templo é perguntar aos doutores sobre a culpa e a responsabilidade. Este livro, que foi considerado por muitas pessoas como herético, e que de certo modo é, porque, como se sabe, heresia significa escolha. O herético é aquele que escolhe outra coisa. Neste livro, Jesus salva a vida, como se sabe, isso é contado nos Evangelhos, porque José recebe, tem um sonho em que um anjo lhe diz que leva o menino para o Egito porque Herodes vai mandar matar as crianças de Belém. José, o José do Evangelho, não do romance, ou também do romance, leva a Virgem, leva o menino para o Egito e não fez aquilo que qualquer pessoa normal faria, que seria avisar os vizinhos de que deveriam pôr a salvo os seus filhos, porque os soldados de Herodes vêm para mandar matar. Então, cria-se aqui uma situação de culpa. José é culpado. E, atrás da culpa, vem a responsabilidade. É isso que leva o adolescente, o pré-adolescente, Jesus, a ir ao templo perguntar aos doutores, não ensinar os doutores, mas perguntar aos doutores se a culpa dos pais passa para os filhos. Havia já muita gente na esplanada que entestava com a íngreme escadaria de acesso. Dos dois lados, ao longo dos muros, encontravam-se as tendas dos bufarinheiros, outras onde se vendiam os animais para o sacrifício. Aqui, além dispersos, os cambistas com as suas bancas, grupos que conversavam, gesticulantes mercadores, guardas romanos a pé e a cavalo vigiando, liteiras a ombros de escravos e também os dromedários, os jumentos ajujados da carga. Por toda a parte um vozear frenético, agora logo os débeis balidos de cordeiros e cabritos, alguns que iam transportados ao colo ou às costas como crianças cansadas, outros arrastados de corda ao pescoço, mas todos a caminho da morte no cutelo e da consumição do fogo. Jesus passou pelo balneário para purificar-se, depois subiu a escadaria e, sem parar, atravessou o átrio dos gentios. Entrou no átrio das mulheres, pela porta entre a sala dos óleos e a sala dos nazarenos, e encontrou o que tinha vindo buscar, os anciãos e os escribas, que, segundo o antigo costume, ali dissertavam sobre a lei, respondiam a questões e davam conselhos. Havia alguns grupos. O rapaz aproximou-se do menos numeroso, no preciso momento em que um homem levantava a mão para fazer uma pergunta. O escriba assentiu com um sinal e o homem disse: explica-me, peço-te, se devemos entender palavra por palavra, sentido por sentido, como está escrito, que as leis que o Senhor deu a Moisés no Monte Sinai, quando prometeu fazer reinar a paz na nossa terra e que ninguém perturbaria o nosso sono, quando anunciou que faria desaparecer dentre nós os animais nocivos e que a espada não passaria pela nossa terra, e também que, perseguindo nós os nossos inimigos, eles cairiam sob a nossa espada. 5 dos vossos perseguirão 100 e 100 dos vossos perseguirão 10.000, disse o Senhor, e os vossos inimigos cairão diante da vossa espada. O escriba olhou com expressão desconfiada ao perguntador. Se seria um intrometido rebelde aqui mandado por Judas Galileu para alvoroçar os espíritos com malévolas e insinuações sobre a passividade do templo perante o poder de Roma, e respondeu brusco e breve: essa palavra disse-a o Senhor quando os nossos pais estavam no deserto e eram perseguidos pelos egípcios. O homem tornou a levantar a mão, sinal de outra pergunta. Devo entender que as palavras do Senhor ditas no Monte Sinai só valeram para aqueles tempos, quando os nossos pais buscavam a terra da promissão? Se assim o entendeste, não és um bom israelita. A palavra do Senhor valeu, vale e valerá por todos os tempos, passados e futuros. A palavra do Senhor estava na mente do Senhor antes que ele falasse, e nela continua depois que ele se calou. Tu foste quem disse o que a mim me proíbes de pensar. Que pensas tu? que o Senhor consente que as nossas espadas não se levantem contra a força que nos está oprimindo, que 100 dos nossos não ousem atrever-se contra 5 dos deles, que 10.000 judeus tenham de encolher-se de 100 romanos, diante de 100 romanos. Estás no templo do Senhor e não num campo de batalha. O Senhor é o Deus dos exércitos. Mas lembra-te, o Senhor impôs as suas condições. Quais? Se cumprires as minhas leis, se guardares os meus preceitos, disse o Senhor. Que leis não cumprimos e que preceitos não guardamos para que tenhamos de aceitar por justa e necessária, como castigo de pecados, a dominação de Roma? O Senhor o saberá. Sim, o Senhor o saberá. Quantas vezes o homem peca sem saber? Mas explica-me por que serve o Senhor do poder de Roma para castigar-nos, em vez de o fazer diretamente, cara a cara, com aqueles a quem elegeu para seu povo. O Senhor conhece os seus fins. O Senhor escolhe os seus meios. Queres então dizer que é vontade do Senhor que os romanos mandem a Israel? Sim. Se é como dizes, temos de concluir que os rebeldes que andam a lutar contra os romanos estão também a lutar contra o Senhor e a sua vontade. Concluis mal. E tu contradizes-te, escriba. O querer de Deus pode ser um não querer. O seu não querer, a sua vontade. Só o querer do homem é verdadeiro querer e não tem importância perante Deus. Assim é. Então, o homem é livre. Sim, para poder ser castigado.
This is an extract from the Gospel according to Jesus Christ. A large crowd had already gathered on the concourse, facing the steep stairway that led up to the entrance. Ranged along the walls on either side were the tents of peddlers and traders selling animals for sacrifice, and here and there were money changers at their stalls, groups of people engaged in conversation, gesticulating merchants, Roman soldiers on foot and on horseback, keeping a watchful eye, slave-borne litters, camels and donkeys laden with baggage, and frenzied shouting everywhere, interrupted by the feeble bleats of lambs and goats, some carried in people's arms or on their backs like tired children, others dragged by a rope around their neck, but all destined to perish by sword or fire. Jesus passed the bathhouse used for purification, climbed the steps, and without stopping, crossed the court of the Gentiles. He entered the court of the women through the door between the chamber of the holy oils and the chamber of the Nazarites, and there he found what he was looking for, the assembly of elders and scribes who traditionally gathered to discuss holy law, answer questions, and dispense advice. They stood in small groups, and the boy joined the smallest of these, just as a man was raising his hand to ask a question. The scribe invited him to speak, and the man asked, "Can you tell me if we should accept, word for word, the commandments given by the Lord to Moses on Mount Sinai, when he promised peace on earth and told us no one would disturb our sleep, when he promised that he would banish dangerous animals from our midst, that the sword would not pass through our land, and that if our enemies pursued us, they would fall under our sword? For, as the Lord himself said, 5 of you will pursue 100 men, 100 of you 10,000, and your enemies will fall under your sword." The scribe eyed the man suspiciously, and thinking he might be a rebel in disguise, sent by Judas the Galilean to stir up trouble with wicked insinuations about the temple's passive resistance to Roman rule, he replied brusquely, "Those words were spoken by the Lord when our forefathers were in the desert, having fled the Egyptians." The man raised his hand a second time and asked another question. "Are we to understand then that the Lord's words on Mount Sinai were meaningful only so long as our forefathers didn't enter the promised land? If that is how you interpret them, you're not a good Israelite. The words of the Lord must prevail in every age, past, present, and future. For they were in his mind before he uttered them, and remained there after he spoke. But it was you yourself who said what you forbid me to think. And what do you think? That the Lord allows that our swords should not be raised against this military force which oppresses us, that 100 of our men lack the courage to face 5 of theirs, that 10,000 Jews cower before 100 Romans. Let me remind you that you are in the temple of the Lord and not on some battlefield. The Lord is the God of legions. True, but do not forget that God imposed his condition. What condition? The Lord said, so long as you observe my laws and keep my commandments. But what are these laws and commandments we have ignored, that we should accept Roman rule as just and necessary punishment for our sins? The Lord must know. Yes, the Lord must know, and how often man sins without knowing. But would you care to explain why the Lord should make use of the Roman army to punish us instead of confronting his chosen people and punishing us himself? The Lord knows his intentions and chooses his means. So you're trying to tell me that the Lord wants the Romans to govern Israel? Yes. Well, if that is so, then the rebels fighting the Romans are opposing the Lord and his holy will. You jump to the wrong conclusion, and you, scribe, contradict yourself. God's will may be not to will, and that not to will may be his will. So the will of man is genuine, yet not of no importance in the eyes of God. That's right. So man is free. Yes, free so that he might be punished. A murmur went up amongst the bystanders. Some stared at the person who had answered the question, based on the text, yet politically inopportune, and they looked at him accusingly, as if he were the one who should answer for the sins of all of Israel, while the skeptical were reassured by the victory of the scribe, who acknowledged their praise and applause with a complacent smile. The scribe looked around him confidently and asked if there were any other questions, like a gladiator who, having dispatched a weak opponent, seeks a more worthy opponent in order to gain greater glory. Another hand went up, and a different question was raised. The Lord spoke to Moses and told him, "The stranger in your midst shall be treated as one of your own, and you will love him as you love yourselves, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt." But before the man could finish speaking, the scribe, still flushed from his victory, interrupted in a sarcastic voice, "I hope you're not about to ask me why we do not treat the Romans as our compatriots, since they too are foreigners. No, what I want to ask is whether the Romans would treat us as their compatriots if both sides spent less time arguing about the differences between their laws and God's. So you too have come here to anger the Lord with blasphemous interpretations of his holy word," said the scribe. "On the contrary, all I ask is whether you truly believe that we're obeying the holy word of the Lord when strangers are strangers, not so much to the land in which we live, as to the religion we profess. To which strangers do you refer? To some in our own day and age, to many in the past, and probably many more in the years to come. I've no time to waste on enigmas and parables. Make yourself clear. When we arrived from Egypt, there were other nations living in the land we now call Israel, whom we had to fight, and in those days we were the strangers, and the Lord commanded us to exterminate the people who opposed his will. The land was promised to us, but had to be conquered. We did not buy it, nor was it offered to us. And now we find ourselves living under foreign rule. We have lost the land we made our own. Israel lives forever in the spirit of the Lord, so that wherever his people may be, whether united or dispersed, there the land of Israel will be. In other words, wherever we Jews find ourselves, others will always be the stranger, certainly in the eyes of the Lord. But the stranger who lives amongst us, according to the word of the Lord, must be our compatriot, and we must love him as we love ourselves, for we were once strangers in Egypt. That is what the Lord said. In that case, the stranger we are expected to love must also be those who, living amongst us, are not so powerful that they can rule us, as at present with the Romans. Yes, I agree. Then tell me, do you believe that if one day we become powerful, the Lord will permit us to oppress a stranger he commanded us to love. All Israel can do is obey the will of the Lord. And since the children of Israel are his chosen people, the Lord wills only what is good for them, even if it means not loving those we should. Yes, if so willed. Willed by whom? The Lord or Israel? By both, for they are one and the same. Thou shalt not violate the stranger's rights, says the Lord. When that stranger has rights, and we acknowledge them, replied the scribe.
Evangelho segundo Jesus Cristo, oh, que palavra forte. O Evangelho segundo Jesus Cristo foi escrito em 1990, publicado em 1991. Só uma pessoa muito distraída não teria percebido que as páginas que ouviram ler foram escritas pensando nos palestinos. A dialética entre o eu e o estrangeiro repõe-se no livro à luz dos acontecimentos dos últimos 50 anos na Palestina. Eu sou, eu era um leitor, um escritor muito lido em Israel. Tenho a, não é a vaidade, porque era a realidade. Eu era o escritor mais lido em Israel. E quando digo mais lido, refiro-me a escritores israelitas e a escritores estrangeiros. Eu era simplesmente o autor mais lido em Israel. Presentemente já não o serei, claro. Mas o que eu vejo é que estas palavras que foram lidas, porque este livro está traduzido em Israel há um bom par de anos, e foram lidos por leitores israelitas, judeus, porque há israelitas árabes, como, enfim, como sabemos, eu pergunto-me o que é que terão pensado quando leram estas páginas, se perceberam que eu estava a falar para eles. Porque o terrível é isto, aquela frase final. Emprestas-me aí, Pilar. Esta parte final, quando diz: agora vais dizer, segundo o que te aconselho as tuas luzes, isto pergunta ao homem, eu escriba, se chegando nós um dia a ser poderosos, permitirá o Senhor que oprimamos os estrangeiros que o mesmo Senhor mandou amar? E o escriba responde: Israel não poderá crer senão o que o Senhor quer. E o Senhor, porque escolheu este povo, quererá tudo quanto for bom para Israel. Mesmo que seja não amar a quem se devia? Sim, se essa for finalmente a sua vontade. De Israel ou do Senhor? De ambos, porque são um. E agora diz o homem que fazia perguntas: não violarás o direito do estrangeiro, palavra do Senhor. E o escriba responde: quando o estrangeiro o tiver e lhe o reconheçamos. Todo o drama, ou uma parte dele, do que está a passar-se na Palestina está contido, de uma certa maneira, nestas palavras. Agora passarei ao ensaio sobre a cegueira, que tem sido muito lido nos Estados Unidos. Parece que se venderam mais de 100 mil exemplares, o que para um autor estrangeiro é importante. E, como se sabe, é a história. É uma história estranha, toda a gente cega de um momento para o outro, o mundo transforma-se num planeta de cegos, exceto uma mulher, que pelas razões que aqui, o livro foi lido aqui com certeza por muitas das pessoas, ou algumas das que estão, sabem portanto do que é que vá. É uma alegoria, é uma forma de dizer... É uma forma de falar do mundo em que vivemos,
contando uma história que parece completamente irreal, fantástica. Em todo caso, creio que é um livro realista, no mais extremo sentido da palavra. Há um grupo de cegos que se une sob, digamos, a proteção, enfim, essa mulher, que é a mulher de um médico, que também faz parte do grupo, é ela quem os guia, é ela quem os orienta, e depois de muitos episódios, eles conseguem regressar, atravessando uma cidade transformada num caos de violência, de tudo que se pode imaginar, e que sabemos que existe. Conseguem chegar à casa que foi a casa do médico. E aí, algo que eles encontram que é absolutamente precioso é a água. Quer dizer, a água que nós malbaratamos, a água que nós desperdiçamos, eles encontram água em casa, água pura. Eles estão, ou depois de semanas de sujos, repugnantes, não, enfim. E aqui é onde se lavam, quer dizer, lavar o corpo, que de uma certa maneira equivale também, enfim, a lavar o espírito. Foi uma noite inquieta. A noite em que eles passam, já a primeira noite que eles passam em casa do médico, foi uma noite inquieta. Vagos, no princípio, imprecisos, os sonhos iam de dormente em dormente, colhiam daqui, colhiam dali, levavam consigo novas memórias, novos segredos, novos desejos. Por isso é que os adormecidos suspiravam e murmuravam: "Este sonho não é meu", diziam. Mas o sonho respondia: "Ainda não conheço os teus sonhos". Foi desta maneira que a rapariga dos óculos escuros ficou a saber quem era o velho da venda preta que dormia ali a dois passos. Desta maneira julgou ele saber quem ela era. Apenas julgou, porque não chega a serem recíprocos os sonhos para que sejam iguais. Começou a chover quando a madrugada clareava. O vento atirou contra as janelas uma bática que soou como um estalido de mil chicotes. A mulher do médico acordou, abriu os olhos e murmurou: "Como chove!" Depois tornou a fechá-los. No quarto continuava a ser noite cerrada. Podia dormir. Não chegou a estar assim um minuto. Despertou abruptamente com a ideia de que tinha algo para fazer. Mas sem compreender ainda o que fosse, a chuva estava a dizer-lhe: "Levanta-te." Que quereria a chuva? Devagar, para não acordar o marido, saiu do quarto, atravessou a sala de estar, parou um instante a olhar os que dormiam nos sofás, depois seguiu pelo corredor até à cozinha. Sobre esta parte do prédio é que a chuva caía com mais força, empurrada pelo vento. Com a manga da bata que trazia posta, limpou a vidraça embaciada da porta e olhou para fora. O céu era todo ele uma única nuvem. A chuva desabava em torrentes. No chão da varanda, amontoadas, estavam as roupas sujas que haviam despido. Estava o saco de plástico ou os sapatos que era preciso lavar. Lavar. O último véu do sono abriu-se subitamente. Era isso que tinha de fazer. Abriu a porta, deu um passo. Ato contínuo, a chuva encharcou-a da cabeça aos pés, como se estivesse debaixo de uma cascata. Tenho de aproveitar esta água, pensou. Tornou a entrar na cozinha e, evitando o mais que podia os ruídos, começou a juntar alguidares, tachos, panelas, tudo o que pudesse recolher um pouco desta chuva que descia do céu em cordas, em cortinas que o vento fazia oscilar, que o vento ia empurrando por cima dos telhados da cidade como uma imensa e rumorosa vassoura. Transportou-os para fora, dispô-los ao longo da varanda, junto à grade. Agora teria água para lavar as roupas imundas, os sapatos nojentos. Que não pare, que esta chuva não pare, murmurava enquanto buscava na cozinha os sabões, os detergentes, os esfregões, tudo o que pudesse servir para limpar um pouco, ou menos um pouco, esta sujidade insuportável da alma. Do corpo, disse, como para corrigir o metafísico pensamento. Depois acrescentou: é o mesmo. Então, como se só essa tivesse de ser a conclusão inevitável, A conciliação harmónica entre o que tinha dito e o que tinha pensado. Despiu de golpe a bata molhada e, nua, recebendo no corpo, umas vezes a carícia, outras vezes a vergastada da chuva, pôs-se a lavar as roupas ao mesmo tempo que a si própria. O rumorjar de águas que a rodeava impediu-a de perceber logo que deixara de estar sozinha. Na porta da varanda tinham aparecido a rapariga dos óculos escuros e a mulher do primeiro cego. Que pressentimentos, que intuições, que vozes interiores as teriam despertado, não se sabe. Tampouco se sabe como conseguiram elas encontrar o caminho para aqui. Não vale a pena procurar agora explicações, as conjeturas são livres. Ajudem-me, disse a mulher do médico quando as viu. Como, se não vemos? Perguntou a mulher do primeiro cego. Tirem a roupa que têm vestida. Quanto a menos tivermos de secar depois, melhor. Mas nós não vemos, repetiu a mulher do primeiro cego. Tanto faz, disse a rapariga dos óculos escuros, faremos o que pudermos. E eu acabarei depois, disse a mulher do médico. Limparei o que ainda tiver ficado sujo. E agora ao trabalho. Vamos, somos a única mulher com dois olhos e seis mãos que há no mundo. Talvez no prédio em frente, por trás daquelas janelas fechadas, alguns cegos, homens, mulheres, acordados pela violência das báticas constantes, com a testa apoiada nas frias vidraças, recobrindo com o bafo da respiração o embaciamento da noite, recordem o tempo em que, assim, tal como estão agora, viam cair a chuva do céu. Não podem imaginar que estão ali, além, três mulheres nuas, nuas como vieram ao mundo, parecem loucas, devem de estar loucas. Pessoas em seu perfeito juízo não se vão pôr a lavar numa varanda exposta aos reparos da vizinhança, menos ainda naquela figura. Que importa que todos estejamos cegos? São coisas que não se devem fazer, meu Deus. Como vai escorrendo a chuva por elas abaixo? Como desce entre os seios? Como se demora e perde na escuridão do púbis? Como enfim alaga e rodeia as coxas? Talvez tenhamos pensado mal delas injustamente. Talvez não sejamos capazes de ver o que de mais belo e glorioso aconteceu alguma vez na história da cidade. Cai do chão da varanda uma toalha de espuma. Quem me dera ir com ela, caindo interminavelmente, limpo, purificado, nu.
As dawn broke, it began to rain. The wind beating fiercely against the windows sounded like the cracking of 1,000 whiplashes. The doctor's wife woke up, opened her eyes and murmured, "Listen to that rain." Then she closed them again. In the room, it was still black night. Now she could sleep. She barely managed a minute. She woke abruptly with the idea that she had something to do, but without yet understanding what it might be. The rain was saying to her, "Get up." What did the rain want? Slowly, so as not to disturb her husband, she left the bedroom, crossed the sitting room, paused for an instant to make sure they were all sleeping on the sofas. Then she proceeded along the corridor as far as the kitchen. It was over this part of the building that the rain fell with the greatest force, driven by the wind. With the sleeve of her dressing gown, she cleaned the steamed up glass panel of the door and looked outside. The entire sky was one great cloud. The rain poured down in torrents. Piled up on the balcony floor were the dirty clothes they'd taken off. There was the plastic bag with the shoes waiting to be washed. Wash. The last veil of sleep was suddenly torn. This was what she had to do. She opened the door, took one step. Immediately the rain drenched her from head to foot as if she were beneath a waterfall. I must take advantage of this water, she thought. She went back into the kitchen and, making as little noise as possible, began gathering together bowls, pots and pans, anything in which she could collect some of the rain that was falling from heaven in sheets, harried about by the wind, sweeping over the roofs of the city like a large and noisy broom. She took them outside, arranged them along the balcony, up against the railing. Now there would be water to wash the dirty clothes and filthy shoes. Don't let it stop, she murmured, as she searched in the kitchen for soap and detergents, scrubbing brushes, anything that might be used to clean a little, at least a little of this unbearable filth of the soul. Of the body, she said, as if to correct this metaphysical thought. Then she added, it's all the same. Then, as if this had to be the inevitable conclusion, the harmonious conciliation between what she had said and what she had thought, she quickly took off her drenched dressing gown, and now, receiving on her body, sometimes a caress, sometimes the whiplash of the rain, she began to wash the clothes and herself at the same time. The sound of water that surrounded her prevented her from noticing right away that she was no longer alone. At the door of the balcony stood the girl with the dark glasses and the wife of the first blind man. We cannot tell what presentiments, what intuition, what inner voices might have roused them, nor do we know how they found their way there. There's no point searching for explanations for the moment. Conjectures are free. "Help me," said the doctor's wife when she saw them. "How, since we cannot see?" asked the wife of the first blind man. "Take off your clothes. The less we have to dry afterwards, the better." "But we can't see," the wife of the first blind man repeated. "It doesn't matter," said the girl with the dark glasses. "We shall do what we can, and I shall finish off later," said the doctor's wife. "I shall clean whatever is still dirty, and now to work. Let's go. We're the only women in the world with two eyes and six hands." Perhaps in the building opposite, behind those closed windows, some blind people, men, women, roused by the noise of the constant beating of the rain, with their head pressed against the cold window panes, covering with their breath on the glass the dullness of the night, remember the time when, like now, they last saw rain falling from the sky. They cannot imagine that there are moreover three naked women out there, as naked as when they came into the world. They seem to be mad. They must be mad. People in their right mind don't start washing on a balcony, exposed to the view of the neighborhood, even less looking like that. What does it matter that we're all blind? These are the things one must not do. My God, how the rain is pouring down on them, how it trickles between their breasts, how it lingers and disappears into the darkness of the pubis, how it finally drenches and flows over the thighs. Perhaps we've judged them wrongly, or perhaps we're unable to see this, the most beautiful and glorious thing that has happened in the history of this city. A sheet of foam flows from the floor of the balcony. If only I could go with it, falling interminably, clean, purified, naked. "Only God sees us," said the wife of the first blind man, who, despite disappointments and setbacks, clings to the belief that God is not blind. To which the doctor's wife replies, "Not even he. The sky is clouded over. Only I can see you." "Am I ugly?" asked the girl with the dark glasses. "You're skinny and dirty. You will never be ugly." "And I?" asked the wife of the first blind man. "You're dirty and skinny like her. Not as pretty, but more than I." "You're beautiful," said the girl with the dark glasses. "How do you know, since you've never seen me?" "I've dreamt of you twice." "When?" "The second time was last night. You were dreaming about the house because you felt safe and calm. It's only natural after all we've been through. In your dream, I was home, and in order to see me, you needed a face, so you invented it." "I too see you as beautiful, and I never dreamt of you," said the wife of the first blind man, which only goes to show that blindness is the good fortune of the ugly. "You're not ugly." "No, as a matter of fact, I'm not. But at my age..." "How old are you?" asked the girl with the dark glasses. "Getting on for 50. Like my mother." "And her?" "Her? What? Is she still beautiful?" "She was more beautiful once. That's what happens to all of us. We were all more beautiful once." "You were never more beautiful," said the wife of the first blind man. Words are like that. They deceive, they pile up. It seems they do not know where to go. And suddenly, because of two or three or four that suddenly come out, simple in themselves, a personal pronoun, an adverb, a verb, an adjective, we have the excitement of seeing them coming irresistibly to the surface, through the skin and the eyes, and upsetting the composure of our feelings. Sometimes the nerves that cannot bear it any longer, they put up with a great deal. They put up with everything. It was as if they were wearing armor, we might say. The doctor's wife has nerves of steel, and yet the doctor's wife is reduced to tears because of a personal pronoun, an adverb, a verb, an adjective, mere grammatical categories, mere labels, just like the two women. The others, indefinite pronouns. They too are crying. They embrace, the woman of the whole sentence, three graces beneath the falling rain. These are moments that cannot last forever. These women have been here for more than an hour. 'Tis time they felt cold. I'm cold, said the girl with the dark glasses. We cannot do anything more with the clothes. The shoes are spick and span. Now it's time for these women to wash themselves. They soak their hair and wash each other's backs, and they laugh as only little girls laugh when they play blind man's buff in the garden before becoming blind. Day broke. The first rays of sun peered over the shoulder of the world before hiding once more beneath the clouds. It continues to rain, but with less force. The washerwomen went back to the kitchen. They dried themselves and rubbed themselves with the towels the doctor's wife had gone to fetch from the bathroom cupboard. Their skin smells strongly of detergent, but such is life. If you haven't got a dog to hunt with, use a cat. The soap disappears in the twinkling of an eye, even though this house seems to have everything. Or is it just that they know how to make the best use of what they've got? At last they cover themselves. Paradise was out there. The dressing gown of the doctor's wife is soaking wet, but she put on a flower dress that she hasn't worn for years, which made her the prettiest of the three.
Gracias.